It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You coming out from the cold and back into the cold here in our studios.
Actually, the cold outside makes it seem like the studios in here are relatively warm for a change. I can't quite explain it. Because so I know it's an illusion, and the frostbite's going to kick in at about 10 till.
Yeah, well, that's just kind of our way of actually slowing you down a bit, you know, in anticipation for the end of the show. So, this week, it looks like we mentioned it briefly last week, some the anticipated cabinet changes, and this week looked like a few more appeared on the radar.
Yeah, we're up to five new nominees now, the first of which we mentioned briefly last week, and mentioned on Counterspin just now, Alberto Gonzalez, the very troubling new nominee for Attorney General with a long record as White House counsel of trying to justify abuse of prisoners in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan and eventually in Iraq and Abu Ghraib. That's just been one of the nominees, and what they really add up to. Bush has yet to make any outside hires of the type of outgoing Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham or even John Ashcroft himself, or former senators who had not worked with Bush before his 2000 election. In this case, so far, the people Bush has nominated of the five, three of them are Texans who go back to his days as governor. In Texas, and Gonzalez is one of those. Another one, the fourth one, worked on his 2000 campaign and is a longtime protege of Vice President Dick Cheney. And the fifth is Condoleezza Rice, who is renowned for having become the closest confidant of Bush during his first term. Rice has been nominated to replace Colin Powell, and that nomination suggests much more of a hard line, much less reliance upon diplomacy, if you can believe that, during Bush's second term, much more of a use of unilateral force and reliance on military force as a substitute for diplomacy. It's going to be kind of interesting to see if the sort of gray areas of diplomacy that the State Department practices will rein in Rice the way they did Powell, who did not necessarily come in with a reputation of this is somebody who is going to militarize the State Department, and he did not, obviously, and he wound up on the losing side of many internal battles in the first term of the Bush administration as a result. So Rice is one of those nominees. We also have Stephen Hadley replacing Rice as a national security advisor. Hadley is the Cheney protege. He's the guy who got some degree of notoriety during his first term for the taking the fall for the insertion in Bush's 2003 State of the Union address of the allegation of the Saddam Hussein government having attempted to purchase yellowcake uranium from Niger. That had been a long discredited allegation, and Hadley was the person who said, "I put that in the address." He's also known very much as a neocon, Cold Warrior, hawk type. And once again, all of these nominations are very much a triumph of the neocons. There's going to be no moderation, and there's going to be very little tolerance for dissenting views of the type of Colin Powell dissent that was heard occasionally during the first term in the Bush administration. Less and less of that dialogue. We also have another Texan, Harriet Myers, who's going to be replacing Gonzalez as White House counsel. We have another Texan, a senior Bush advisor, Margaret Spellings, who was one of the, as Bush's advisor in the first term on domestic policy, was one of the primary people behind the No Child Left Behind Act. She's going to be coming in as education secretary to replace Rod Page. And she is a former education lobbyist from Houston who goes back with Bush into his first term as Texas governor also. These again are very much a triumph of prizing loyalty and loyalty to Bush in particular over trying to hire the best person for the job, and It's very much a tight cluster of neocon hires. It's very troubling. And,
yeah, it's
and
interesting that Rod Page, the first education secretary, actually had some experience as a school principal. In a school district, and Spelling does not. She's literally just a political hack, really.
Yeah, she was a lobbyist.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It's kind of emblematic of where the Bush administration is going with some of these new appointments.
Yeah, very, very much so. And the problem with this, again, is you're going to get very little diversity of views. You're going to get very few people who have the credibility to tell Bush when he's wrong on one or another. Of course, as we learned from his first term, he doesn't make any mistakes. But, you know, and on the off chance that he ever might, there's going to be nobody who can... nobody can stand up to him, and he's intentionally surrounding himself with these types of people. It's very troubling, and very much troubling when you compare it with his pledge after the election that he wants to win the trust of the people who voted for John Kerry. This is not the way to go about that.
And we can't even expect any feedback from focus groups or protesters. So
no.
All right. Well. You were pointing out before we went live, there's also something happening with an anti-abortion rider.
This is something that got snuck in by the House Republicans, and again, an effect of the election where the social conservatives are kind of feeling their oats and saying, we have a lot of power now and we're going to flex it. This is a rider that's being put into the Congressional Omnibus Spending Bill, which is a bill that they have to pass by midnight tonight in order to continue federal funding for the EPA and the National Park Service and all sorts of different government agencies. So it's probably going to go to a vote today, and it was snuck in by negotiators between the House and the Senate yesterday. This would basically allow any hospital or any service provider to refuse to provide abortions for reasons of conscience or whatever reason. They don't have to have a reason necessarily, and they would still be eligible for federal funding. Now, this is directly affects Washington State, because Washington State is one of only four states in the country that has any kind of state funding for Medicaid abortions for poor women who go to a hospital or go to a service provider in Washington State. This allows hospitals to refuse to accept that funding, even though the funding's on the table. Now, this is something that Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California has said she's going to try and use procedural filibusters, these kinds of things, in order to try and slow down this bill and try and get changes in it. She's gotten very little support for that so far. You would think that the Democratic women senators from Washington State, Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, should be all over this. So it might be a good idea for anybody who's interested in listening to email or even phone call. I don't know if they'll answer the switchboard on Saturday and at the congressional office, but contact Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray and say, try and do something to stop this, because this will directly affect the lives of poor women in Washington State.
Any sense for, in terms of these last-minute riders that are thrown onto the omnibus bill, how many things get thrown onto a bill like that?
Quite a few, and a lot of them are pork projects, projects for particular states or congressional districts back home. That sort of undermine the pledge of the White House to try and rein in their spending. It's a very common device, and particularly for a bill like this where Congress has to pass it, and there's going to be all kinds of problems if Congress doesn't pass it. It's very uncommon for a bill to be put into it that writes law the way this does. It's one thing to have a line item for spending that underwrites a dam or a highway project or something like that back home. It's something else entirely to put something in that writes law for something like this that affects how federal tax dollars are dispersed and who's eligible and who's not eligible.
All right. Well, moving along, I saw this week that the mad cow alert went up to Code Orange.
Yes, it did. The USDA has been pursuing its testing goal. Now, they said that, since the last mad cow case was discovered here in Washington State, was it last year?
Yeah.
It's been about a year.
Yeah, it was December 9th.
It's interesting, something about this time of year is when the mad cow cases get discovered, but... yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Happy holidays to you.
I think there was actually a couple in like July. There was also
there were a couple of initial quick tests that tested inconclusive. Now when they get a positive reading on the quick test, which is the test that's given to all the supposedly downer cows and cows over a certain age and any cows that are exhibiting any kind of neurological signs like they're staggering or they're having trouble walking or something. They give them this quick test, and if the quick test shows positive, they don't say, oh, she's positive for mad cow disease. They say the cow's test is inconclusive. And then they pull the cow aside and they run another quick test, and if that's positive, then they run it. They kill it. They kill the cow. They take a brain sample and they ship it off to Ames, Iowa, the one lab in the country that can run the absolutely definitive test, and that definitive test takes from 4 to 7 days to run, and then the cow's carcass is held while that test is run. If that test comes back negative, then they release the carcass, or more likely they send it for dog food, since by that time the carcass is probably not in great shape for human consumption. Or if the test is positive, then they say, okay, this is cow had mad cow disease. Now, the cows that were tested in July had one quick test positive, and then a second quick test tested negative, and so they were released to be eaten. Now, this one cow that was tested had three quick tests test positive. The maker of the test says that when that happens, that it's about a 95% chance that the cow does have mad cow disease. But the USDA, they're saying they are holding that cow's carcass, but they're not going to tell the media or the public where the cow came from, what farm it came from, what slaughterhouse it went through, et cetera, until the long term, the test that takes 4 to 7 days comes back positive. So in the meantime, while that cow's carcass is being held, other animals that might be infected from the same farm or from the same slaughterhouse or from the same feedlot are going through the system. I think this is absolutely ridiculous when this cow has had three quick tests come back positive or inconclusive, if you're really taking the terminology of the USDA, and it's highly likely that it has mad cow disease. Nobody is telling the public where the meat came from and where the other animals who might be from the same herd or from the same feedlot, where they're coming through the system.
I think it's also important to reiterate for people that, you know, haven't heard us talk about this in a while, that case back in December of last year that turned up positive was not from a downer cow, it was from a regular cow.
That was walking.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that the cows that they test now are all downer cows, so they're not
right.
even testing the ones
right.
that turned up positive before.
Yeah, of the 3 to 4 million carcasses that pass through the system, 3 to 4 million animals that pass through the system to be slaughtered, only about, I think it's about 142,000 have been tested so far this year. And those cows are only the cows that exhibit signs, downer cows, cows that aren't walking, and cows that are over a certain age. Because our slaughter system is taking animals at a younger and younger age to pass them through the system, that means not very many animals are being tested. So of the, 3.5 to 4 million animals that pass through the system, if you're only testing 150 to 200,000 a year, that's not good enough.
Right, and that's not even dealing, again, with the other 35 million that, we process mm-hmm. 35 million a year, so... Or thereabouts, give or take a million.
35 million. I missed it by a decimal point.
Yeah. I'm loving it.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I thought you were talking specifically of the downers.
No. Okay. I was trying to capture the whole number.
Oh, yeah.
And even though the fact that we're processing younger and younger animals for slaughter doesn't mean that we're not processing animals that have the disease, because it is possible for the animals to have the abnormal prions and the disease and not exhibit symptoms yet.
And real quickly, in a related note this week, I also just remembered that there's a big effort in, I can't remember, Congress or the Senate, to remove the laws that were going to put labeling on foods to tell you the origin of where it came from. So, these people, they're looking out for somebody, and it's not us.
It's not us,
yeah.
No. It's
we're going to see more and more of this with a lack of checks and balances in the White House and the Congress and the Senate. It's all controlled by the same party. And it's the party of corporate interests, the party of lobbyists. That's where the legislation is going to be coming from for the next couple of years. We're just going to have to be extremely vigilant.
Well, I think they're actually pretty heavy on the checks. They're writing those up just as fast as they
can. It's the balances that aren't getting taken care of. It's true. As we could see from the deficit.
So anything else on that, or should we jump over to This Week in Iraq?
This Week in Iraq.
On Tuesday, U.S. troops and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters moved in to retake control of Mosul, which is Iraq's third largest city. After a couple of skirmishes, the insurgents gave way and disappeared, which is utilizing a standard guerrilla tactic. Now, they left behind them at least 6 destroyed police stations, several ransacked government buildings, and a demolished and demoralized Iraqi police force with only about 100 officers left for the whole city of Mosul, which has about 3 million people. At least 2 of the police stations retaken by U.S. troops have come under mortar fire this week, and 3 neighborhoods of Mosul are still under the control of the guerrillas, the old city, Al-Yarmouk, and the Sumer sector. Likewise, fighting continues in Fallujah, while reporters following U.S. troops are having trouble finding the bodies of the estimated 1,600 to 2,000 dead insurgents that U.S. troops say they have killed. New York Times reported that Iraqi troops have done little or no fighting in Fallujah, and they're being utilized primarily to occupy seized mosques and to guard prisoners. Now, speaking of prisoners, the Pentagon was forced to admit that of the 1,000 or so prisoners taken in Fallujah, only about 15 of them are foreigners, and nearly all of those are from Syria. Now, article that mentions that, it's an article from the LA Times, and the title of the article is "Few Foreign Fighters Among Insurgents," says that the Pentagon says there's some 5% of foreign fighters that were in Fallujah. However, if you figure out what percentage 15 is of 1,000 or more, it turns out to be less than 1.5%. And if they're all from Syria, almost all but 2 are from Syria, then you might draw the conclusion that those folks who are from Syria are from just beyond the border of the country and have relatives in Iraq and crossed over to help their relatives fight against the U.S. occupiers. Another issue regarding prisoners, video was released this week of a U.S. soldier executing a wounded and helpless Iraqi prisoner. The U.S. soldier himself was wounded at the time and suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder after having seen one of his buddies killed from handling a dead insurgent's body that was rigged to explode. Because of a shortage of U.S. troops in Iraq, wounded and stressed U.S. troops are being sent back into combat, and the results are therefore horrific and entirely predictable. Other results of the siege and destruction of Fallujah. The fighting continues around the country this week in the following cities and towns in Iraq: Ramadi, Samarra, Bakuba, Zahara, Baiji, Balad, Qaim, Kirkuk, Tal Afar, Hilla, Burriz, Suwayra, Hit, and, of course, the capital city of Baghdad, where the Asia Times Online...
Might it be easier to list the cities where fighting is not taking place?
It might be. The Asia Times Online reports that insurgents have infiltrated several neighborhoods of the capital city, including Hur Rajab, Abu Ghraib, Al-Abidi, Suwayra, Salman Bakh, Latifiya, Yusufiya, and parts of the southern suburb of Adura. Insurgents also took over the town of Taji, 12 miles north of Baghdad, and blew up 4 oil wells near the city of Kirkuk and a pipeline carrying oil to the country's largest refinery at Baiji. Later in the week, they also blew up a pipeline near the city, near the little town of Taji, which they took over earlier in the week. The LA Times reported on Thursday that British troops have withdrawn from the southern Iraqi city of Amara because, quote, they got tired of fighting their way out every time they needed to be resupplied, end quote. Now they just run patrols on the outskirts of town and they peer into the city with their night vision goggles to see what's happening. Meanwhile, Interpress Wire Service reports that Iraqi, this is a quote, Iraqi rebels are now in control of large areas of Ramadi, Samarra, Haditha, Bakuba, Hit, Qaim, Latifiyah, Taji, and Qaldiya. Fighting has been reported also in the Shia holy city of Karbala. The uprising has spread across the capital as well. The districts Al-Dora, Al-Amariya, Abu Ghraib, Al-Adamiya, and Kandari are now largely controlled by resistance fighters. And if you open up your Seattle Post-Intelligencer this morning, you'll see an article about an attack on a police station in the Al-Adamiya section of Baghdad.
Yeah, that was in the Times this morning also.
Mm-hmm. Now, as for the destruction in Fallujah itself, U.S. Marines are going around the city trying to make an estimate of how much destruction has occurred in order to figure out how much money the U.S. government and the Iraqi interim government should spend on rebuilding in Fallujah. The estimates keep going up. First they said $50 million, and then they said $70 million, and then they said $80 million, and now they're saying $100 million. Sergeant Todd Bowers, one of the Marines who is in the unit trying to estimate the damage, he's a civil affairs specialist in the 3rd Battalion, 5th Regiment, said, quote, it's incredible, the destruction. It's overwhelming. My first question is, where to begin? Now, as for the impact on the civilians in Fallujah, Red Cross officials in Baghdad estimate that at least 800 civilians have died inside Fallujah. That's a low figure based on interviews with refugees and the people that they left regarding the people that they left behind, and phone interviews with families who are still trapped inside Fallujah by the fighting and the U.S. military cordon. U.S. troops have not allowed aid convoys into the city because they say it is too dangerous, and indeed the Red Crescent agency has said that they will not send any convoys into the city until they have guarantees from both U.S. troops and from the insurgents that they will not be attacked. Well, they have that okay from U.S. troops, but because they cannot get in touch with any leaders among the insurgents, they can't get that confirmation from them, and so the Red Crescent is simply not going into the city. Of the estimated... Now, in the meantime, the U.S. troops say that they are taking care of the civilians that they find inside the city. But if you read the reports from reporters who are embedded with U.S. units, it's clear that U.S. troops are having a hard time figuring out even what to do with civilians. They're telling them to go to mosques to collect there in order to be fed. However, we also see a videotape this week of a U.S. soldier shooting a prisoner in a mosque. So there is some question about whether civilians will consider that a safe thing to do. And U.S. troops are giving them their own ready-to-eat meals because they have very little food to give to civilians that they find in Fallujah. Of the estimated 250,000 to 300,000 refugees who fled the city, most went to villages and towns on the outskirts nearby. They are in desperate need of food and medical supplies, and the situation is most grave in Habaniya, where there's a very bad shortage of clean drinking water. The roads, however, are still too dangerous to get many supplies through, even to those folks. And there are very few relief agencies working in Iraq. As I said, the Red Cross and Red Crescent is pretty much it. Other aid agencies that have quit the country in recent months include CARE International. World Vision just announced that they were withdrawing. Doctors Without Borders left a few months ago. And the UNHCR, the UN Human Rights Commission, is no longer operating inside the country of Iraq. They only have officials outside of the country who are trying to make estimates of what's going on from outside. So those folks are, so the refugee situation that the Bush administration created by telling people that they had to leave the city of Fallujah in order to stay safe means that they left the city and now they're stuck. And now, no one is providing for them.
Now they're starving to death and there's nobody to provide for them.
Yeah.
And they have nowhere to go.
Nobody is providing anything for them. Now, in other Iraq news, 46 groups have announced that they will boycott the elections in January. A lot of those are small groups. However, the list of people who signed the boycott letter includes the Muslim Scholars Association, which represents a large portion of the Sunni population. But it also includes women's groups, Turkmen and Christian groups, plus two significant Shiite organizations also signed the boycott letter. The interim government, meanwhile, held a one-day summit, and they held it in the Kurdish region, which is the only part of the country where there isn't continuous fighting going on. That's in the three tiny Kurdish provinces in the north of the country. They held a one-day summit there to discuss the upcoming elections. Now, they were supposed to discuss how the elections would be organized and how the voting would go. What they ended up discussing was whether or not to delay the elections, and the consensus was they needed to delay the elections. However, it's unclear who has the power to do this. Alawi will have to consult with the UN and the U.S. Embassy on this point to decide whether or not he actually has power to say we need to delay the elections for a couple of months because of the security situation. Now, the Shiites and Kurdish parties, who are in the interim assembly, are against any delay. They think the sooner the election will happen, the more likely they are to win majorities in the government. So they are pushing for the elections to go on time. So it'll be interesting to watch this because it might lead to infighting within the current puppet regime. It'll be kind of fun to watch that. Now, the last piece of information I want to talk about on Iraq was six NATO nations have refused to send any of their troops to help train a new Iraqi army. This is after after NATO agreed in principle that they should send trainers to Iraq to train the new Iraqi army. Six nations in the alliance said that they would not send their own troops for this purpose: Germany, Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Spain, and Greece. Unfortunately, that number includes nations whose personnel are most highly qualified to do that job. It's a tit for tat. While the Bush administration is seeking to undermine the UN by refusing a UN-run peacekeeping force for Iraq, these nations are really happy to let NATO disintegrate in response to that. NATO has always been a U.S. foothold into European politics, and now that the European Union has its own security force, these nations really see it as time to kick the U.S. out of European politics. And it really is kind of a little tit-for-tat on the Bush administration. So on that happy note, we'll just close out This Week in Iraq.
All right. I also saw, just quickly, I think it was in today's paper, there was an article about that potentially the several European countries, Germany and the U.S., were talking about relieving the debt of Iraq. It was a group called the Paris Club or something. Mm-hmm. They're looking at, like,
not forgiving it?
No, actually forgiving, 80% of it.
Yeah, the U.S. has been pushing for the Paris Club to forgive Iraq's enormous debt to the Paris Group of Nations.
Yeah, and not just the Paris Club, but all nations, including Japan as well.
Including Russia, yeah. Japan. Japan is the only nation that said it would forgive some debt, definitely. So this is news that the Paris Club says that they are looking at forgiving debt. They have in the past said that, sure, we'll forgive maybe 50% of the debt, and that hasn't been enough for the Bush administration. They've been pushing for 80 to 90%. So it'll be interesting to see what the final figures are on that.
Yeah, this is the same Bush administration, of course, has been very insistent that debtor nations in the global south pay off all their debts regardless.
Yeah, and that's been an issue around that topic, too, because other nations and other groups have been, anti-poverty groups have been saying, well, if you're going to do this for Iraq, why aren't you going to do this for other nations who are in even worse situation, you know, and don't have oil resources to help pay off their debts?
So maybe it'll set a positive precedent.
Oh, well, I don't think it will, but I think the Bush administration will resist tooth and nail for other poorer nations to get debt relief, but we'll see.
All right.
It's all a question of whose friends are getting enriched by the process.
Yeah.
All right. With that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found at bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, your public library, and other places where you can find free periodicals. We can also be found on the web at our website, www.eatthestate.org. That's www.eatthestate.org, where you can read our hopefully our current issue. Sometimes gets posted a little bit late, and you can also make a donation to us from our website, or you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.